CFUV 101.9 FM broadcasts from the Songhees and Wasanich territories, also known as Victoria, BC. You can listen to our music, spoken word, and multicultural programs anywhere, anytime at cfuv.ca.
Welcome back to Guerrilla Radio's Home Edition, recorded on the dates June 10th and 12th, 2021. Well, after the shock, fear, and uncertainty had subsided somewhat, benefits of the pandemic soon became apparent. Who didn't marvel in those early days at the serene stillness, the peace and quietude settling over the cities like a muffling snowfall, surprising commuters and putting a halt to our frantic everyday? And didn't the stars seem closer then, the air fresher, and wasn't there too an unaccustomed moment to hear one's thoughts, to take time to think? Best-selling award-winning Canadian author J.B. McKinnon's first book, The 100 Mile Diet, co-written with Alyssa Smith, was an international sensation, catalyzing the locavore movement. He followed that with The Once and Future World, Nature as It Was, As It Is, As It Could Be, the poignant examination of nature's past, the parlous Anthropocene present, and our possible futures. His latest is The Day the World Stops Shopping, a book he says began as a thought experiment and work of imaginative reporting that world events caught up with. J.B. McKinnon in the first half. And the results of last month's Syrian presidential election was hardly surprising. The besieged country's leader, Bashar al-Assad, won by a margin. Poll-watching cliches like landslide victory can't do justice. Equally unsurprising was the Western press and the world community reaction to that victory. Eva Bartlett is an independent Canadian journalist and activist who has lived in and reported extensively from Syria over the last decade. Eva Bartlett and Syria still standing after a decade of war in the second half. But first, J.B. McKinnon and Stopping What We Must and Can't Shopping. Well, welcome back to the program, James.
Thank you very much. Glad to be back.
Well, it's my great pleasure, of course. Now, James, we're informed ad nauseum that we can and will return to pre-COVID normalcy and even build back better our world that's been so rudely interrupted. James, even though for the purpose of your book's thesis, your thought experiment on halting the consumer juggernaut, the pandemic effect was just like a mere blip. But what did we learn from that momentary shopping cessation shock? Or did we learn anything?
I think we learned all kinds of things, but I think the main thing we learned was just the awesome power of slowing down consumption and how that plays out in every sphere of culture and society.
Well, you, for this book, you looked at a lot of different cultures and a lot of different societies. In the prologue, you travel to Namibia and bear with me here for a second. You speak with a fellow called Gitakau. Do you want to pronounce Gitakau's name if you can do it?
I'm not sure I'll do better than you, but it's Gitakau. So this is a group of people who've been living in the Kalahari Desert in Namibia more or less continuously, probably continuously, for 150,000 years. And across that time, they've never really developed a very, you know, very much attachment to possessions. They live a very simple material life.
And so how does his story play in, besides the obvious fact that people can get along for 150,000 years without a smartphone? how does he play into the narrative of the book?
You know, the reason I wanted to start with him is because, well, for two reasons, I think. One is that I often hear people say, well, we can't stop consuming. It's in our genes. It's hardwired into us. We don't have any choice. This is who we are as human beings. And, you know, to say that ignores cultures like this one in the Kalahari, where, you know, obviously they haven't gone down that same path. So I wanted immediately to dispel this idea for the reader that we don't have any other choice. And this particular individual, Gitakau, he is somebody who, you know, he hasn't only lived out in the middle of the desert in, you know, the simplest possible ways. He's also worked in a town. He was a member of the army. And yet he chose to go back to his original roots and live a very simple life in the desert. And I think that, you know, it speaks to two things. It speaks to, you know, a lot of our feeling that maybe there is some ancient part of us that longs for that kind of simplicity. But it also speaks to a lot of our fears around what it would mean to live a simple life. Does it mean that we have to go right down to you know, nothing but the most basic rudimentary possessions?
Is he and the Jiaquanzi people that he belongs to, are they really so unusual when you look at the broader world? When you look at first peoples across the world, I think they have a lot more in common with the Bushmen of the Kalahari than they do with modern consumer society.
I think you're exactly right. I mean, anthropology and archaeology, and of course the peoples themselves, will tell us now that these are the kinds of traditions that were upheld by many different cultures, and you don't even have to roll back the history of Western society very far before you start to encounter a very different relationship with materialism. I mean, throughout most of our history, we had a very slow-growing, low-resource-consuming existence, and it's really only a blip in history where we've become this hyper-consumer culture.
Where did we go wrong? I mean, is there a point in time where we can say, and roll back the clock a little bit and say, oh, this is where we made a wrong turn? And would that be instructive in our next steps towards trying to reverse some of what looks like a disastrous course we're on?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's often difficult to put a perfect finger on where things went wrong, but certainly we've seen a dramatic acceleration in the, you know, since the Industrial Revolution into the 20th century, and then particularly this point that people call the Great Acceleration, beginning in around the 1960s, when just everything, you know, population, consumption, resource use, carbon emissions, everything just skyrockets.
Yeah, we look at those go-go decades, and that, when we think of consumption, at least I do, I think of the bright lights and the fast cars and the boogie nights and all of that sort of stuff. But what we see now with our economies in the West is this bifurcation of haves and have-nots, and yet the consumption patterns seem to be still accelerating when fewer and fewer people are taking part in this go-go economy. How is that possible?
Well, I mean, it's possible through all of the usual predictors. I mean, incredible concentrations of wealth, colonialism that gathers wealth from around the world into a handful of rich countries. I mean, the mechanisms are pretty clear and familiar to us, but it's certainly true that they're worsening. I mean, you see super consumers in poorer countries around the world as a tiny minority among a large majorities of have-nots, and you see Western societies moving more and more in that direction.
Yeah, and then there's China, of course. In the book, again, the book is The Day the World Stops Shopping. You've got a lot of information and coming from all quarters, but the subtitle or the sub-theme of it here is a line that really resonated with me, and that is, we can't stop shopping, and yet we must. And you say that this is the consumer dilemma. Why can't we stop?
I think we can stop, but I mean, certainly the narrative that we've faced for decades now is that we can't. This is the dilemma that really brought me into the book. I do a lot of environmental writing, and every environmental issue I cared to look at, the closer I looked, the more it seemed to be driven by consumption and by consumerism. So, you know, the planet does really need us to slow down consumption. But we do know, and we saw again in the pandemic, that we've constructed an economy that's so dependent on consumption that it feels like we can't stop. because every time we do slow, every time we do put the wallets away and the cash registers stop ringing, people lose their jobs, businesses are shuttered. You have all of the terrible consequences of recessions and depressions.
We're seeing that now. And also we're seeing this great, well, you live in Vancouver, I'm across the water here in Victoria. We're two of the most expensive cities in Canada and amongst the top in some of the world cities for the poor affordability, I'll put it that way. Even if I'm not consuming, I live a simple lifestyle, but I have to pay enormous rents. I have to go to work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And this is why, I mean, one of the big takeaways for me from working on this, and part of the reason that I employed this kind of thought experiment approach was to see, well, can we look beyond the dilemma somehow? And I thought, well, okay, I can do that if I run an experiment where on the written page, I just make the stop and shop and see what plays out from there. And what I hoped would happen through that is that I'd eventually get a sense of what a lower consuming society might look like, and then reverse engineer from there to say, well, how would we get there? And what comes out of that is the approach that we've taken to encouraging people to consume less or to live more simply for a long time has been to ask individuals to change and change their consumption. And it's clear to me at this point that that's, you know, that's not the right approach. We need to look at this as changes we need to make in the system so that we end up with a lower consuming society that we can all live in.
Yeah, you turn the old saying, be the change you want to see in the world. You say, yeah, you can be the change you want to see in the world, but it's not going to change the world.
Yeah, not in this case. We've seen again and again through history, we've seen these movements. I mean, I was really struck by this as I did the research, that even things like decluttering have had their moment more than one time in the past. And in every one of these cases, a certain number of people, usually not a very large fraction of society, will really engage with the idea of deconsumerism. And then that movement will fall apart. And we will all, you know, the consumer engines will rev back up to full throttle. That, of course, is what's predicted to happen again after the pandemic, despite the fact that I think quite literally millions of people around the world have had reckonings with their values and priorities that make them, I think people are going to be looking at this return to full throttle consumption with a lot of disquiet and possibly even despair.
I could share that despair. It's fading now, but I've got to admit, I liked the quiet in the first month or so when everything was shut down, where you didn't hear all the traffic. It was very subdued, and I rather liked that. And when it started coming back, it was like, oh, at the end of a beloved season that you fear you'll never see again, you know?
Yeah, it's almost an unspoken thing at this point. And what I found was that's also the case with recessions and depressions. You do actually find people who like the slowdown in the pace of life. You know, certainly in the pandemic, I heard from all kinds of different people at that time about how they were, particularly, I think, the extra time they had and the way that allowed them to express different values that they don't usually have time to express because they're bound up in a earn and spend cycle, whether that's, as you pointed out earlier, at kind of the desperate earn and spend cycle of surviving in a super high cost city like Vancouver or Victoria, or the more materialism driven earn and spend cycle where you're constantly chasing that fancier car and bigger house and more splendid watch.
Yeah, well, I'm definitely a member of the former, and I was searching for an analogy of this. And you remember that movie about the French Foreign Legion so many years ago called March or Die? Well, that's what I was thinking. You know, it's like shop or die, but I mean, or spend or die, but it could be don't shop and die as well.
Yeah, it's. I mean, we do have to take this idea of shifting to a lower consuming society really seriously, because the consequences of making that kind of change are obviously meaningful. I mean, if you slow down consumption, there are these real effects. They do ripple out. They do span the globe. You know, if I stop buying shirts and jeans, then people who make shirts and jeans in Turkey or Bangladesh or China or Vietnam are going to feel the consequences of that. So it is something that needs to be approached cautiously, but it is also really achievable. It is something that we can do.
Yeah, you're right, and I'll quote you here. Buy half as many clothes and it's an asteroid strike on the world economy. Your wardrobe, on the other hand, hasn't begun to shrunk. To shrink, rather. So, you know, you bring up something that was very poignant for me. Back in 2013, there was a terrible accident in Bangladesh, and more than 1,000 workers were killed in the Rana Plaza collapse. And at the time, what was really so poignant, and I recall it vividly, I actually wrote an article about it because Joe Fresh, the Canadian clothier, their clothes were found with their labels amongst the wreckage. And what made it so poignant in the press was a photograph of a man and a woman dead, but in a tender embrace below the rubble. And I think that moved so many people to think, oh, how terrible these workers in Bangladesh have it. But then when you talk about that disaster and the reaction of the people in Bangladesh, they're reaction to what happened then after that at the time was a boycott and all of this sort of stuff. But they're saying, no, place your orders, please keep buying. We have to have the work.
Yeah. I mean, I think the message they were sending was, look, we want to transform this. We want, you know, obviously they wanted a safer workplace, but they didn't want to be cut off cold turkey from the benefits of Western consumerism. And I mean, it's interesting you bring up Bangladesh because one of my favorite characters or figures in the book is a guy named Abdullah Al-Maher, who it was just a really interesting encounter that I had with him because I thought, well, who's going to strongly defend the system of clothes production in Bangladesh and the necessity of Western consumption to that clothes production? I thought, okay, well, CEOs of clothes manufacturing plants in Bangladesh, they're the people who are going to give me the most robust challenge around this. So I tried to contact some of them, and Maher, as he calls himself, he got back in touch with me just like right away. It was like he was waiting for my call. I mean, it was nothing like what I anticipated. I anticipated this guy saying, yeah, we got to keep going the way we're going. Not at all. I mean, he says, fast fashion hasn't been good for his country. It hasn't been good for his workers. It hasn't been good for his company. He was, in fact, all for precisely the idea that I wanted to bounce off him, which was, you know, what would happen if instead of moving more and more in the direction of fast fashion and disposable clothing, we moved in the direction of people buying fewer clothes that were better made. He thought that was exactly the direction that he would want to go. You know, the work is more dignified. The work would be less stressful. If people paid more for the clothing, then, you know, he can spread some of that to his workers. It was just fascinating to go to somebody who I thought would be the most attached to this idea and discover that even he found Western consumption appalling.
In an interview that you gave in The Guardian recently, you quote, the writer quotes Maher saying, yeah, and this would be the end of the rat race, that it would see a drastic reduction of manufacturers in Bangladesh, but it would also mean better conditions for the workers.
Yeah, I put to him at one point, what would be the kind of difference in price that would be meaningful to his company and to the people who work for him? And I thought he was going to say, oh, like if we paid $5 more per garment or something like this. And without thinking, he said, well, 2 cents. Like if people were willing to pay 2 cents more, then that would make a meaningful difference in his ability to you know, slow down the pace of production, pay people a little bit more money. And I mean, 2 cents in Canada is a rounding error, right? I mean, we don't even put down those pennies anymore.
Right. But what about reducing our consumption, though? I mean, you argue too that prices, if the true prices were worked into products, resources, and finished goods, that it would change our pattern of consumption. If it was only 2 cents, wouldn't we just keep on consuming at the same rate?
Yeah, I think he's just saying that, you know, look, even that small an increase in cost, because people talk about, well, you know, if we're going to have durable goods, then they're going to cost a lot more money. But he's pointing out that even with a 2 cent increase, he could cut down the number of clothes he's producing without having to fire anybody, without having to cut anybody's wages, even with 2 cents. And I mean, obviously, we can think bigger than that. We could think about people paying a dollar more or $2 more. You know, one of the things I found really striking in the conversation with him was how offended he was by what we do pay for the things that they make. You know, so they, you know, that factory is full of people who make things. That's their job. And then they're aware that we are buying the things that they make for, you know, $4 a shirt or a fill a bag sale where you get, you know, maybe 10 or 12 garments for $5 or something like this. I mean, they're aware that this is how much we're valuing their labor.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with J.B. McKinnon. He is the author or co-author of 5 books of nonfiction, an award-winning journalist. His work has appeared in such publications as The New Yorker, National Geographic, and The Atlantic, as well as the Best American Science and Nature Writing Anthologies. He's an adjunct professor, too, of journalism at the University of British Columbia, where he teaches feature writing. We're talking today about his book. You, in the book, James, you have a quote from Amanda Rinderly. You ask her, if she had a wish, if you could grant her with a magic wand one thing that she would like to change in the world of consumption, she says she'd like to make the true costs of products known to everyone. Can you explain what that means?
Sure. True cost pricing means building in the costs of the social and environmental consequences of the lifespan of a product from its production to its disposal into the price of the product. So if you are, for example, producing something that uses up a lot of water, pollutes fresh water, or pollutes the air, you know, emits carbon, then in some way or another, we calculate the costs of that into the product and add it to the price. And if you have a true cost type system, then products like the one that Amanda Rinderly's company, Tuckerman & Co. makes, which is very high quality dress shirts that are made with vegetable ivory and, you know, the most sustainable cottons they can get, and they are made to last, could finally compete on price point with products that are made without any thought to any of those values, from labor conditions to environmental consequences.
But doesn't that make us regular schmoes wearing sackcloth and stuff? I mean, when are we going to be naked in this new world?
No, because, I mean, you look at these dress shirts that they're trying to make. Right now, they're about $200. But part of the reason that they're $200 is because nothing they do fits into the system that we have right now for producing clothes. Everything about the clothes production system is geared towards cheap and high volume and high turnover. And so, you know, they have to go off and find, like, she had to find literally the finest mill in the world to produce their fabric. You know, they had one choice for the kind of buttons they wanted to get. If the system was normalized towards producing durable goods, then prices for those things would drop down. And if you had true cost pricing, then the price of producing a constant stream of low quality goods would go up. So we'd end up with a system that was made it easier for all of us to access higher quality goods. I think there would still be a bandwidth there. We wouldn't all get the very best of best quality goods. I mean, those would still be reserved for those who, you know, who had the money to buy them, but we would all be getting better, more long lasting things that we didn't have to buy so many of.
Well, and maybe not buying at all. You know, I talked to Ellen Moore recently of Mining Watch, and she said to me something astonishing, that your average gold wedding band creates 20 tons of rock and slag waste to produce for one golden ring.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly support the idea of buying less overall. And when people talk about this economy built more around durable goods, the phrase that's often used is buy less, buy better. The buy less is still first there, right? It's and what I am actually concerned about is, and what we're already starting to see, is that you do see companies out there that are making the effort to produce high quality goods. They're very expensive for the reasons that we've talked about, and people are scooping them up. So I think there is the risk that because of the consumer mentality, we just shift to buy more, buy better, rather than buy less, buy better. I mean, we do still have to keep our eye on the fundamental issue, which is we need to reduce the sheer volume of consumption.
For cheap guys like me or poorer people out there, that's not a huge issue in that respect, although I still have to pay the big rent, as I mentioned. But you have a quote from the Depression era that you say, I used it up, wore it out, made it do, or did without. And that's the ethic going forward on this. I mentioned earlier the tagline to build back better after the COVID thing. And we hear a lot of that from our government in the United States and in other places as well. But better is a pretty relative term. I'm curious, and maybe we can finish on this, James, is that you were in Ecuador, where Ecuador is a country that lives perfectly in balance. Its consumption model is in balance with what the world can sustain, given its population, etc. But they have a saying down there to live better. Can you wrap up maybe what they mean by that phrase and how that relates to the theme of your book? And again, it's the day the world stops shopping.
Yeah, in Ecuador, this live better or bien vivir approach is that you not focus on your possessions, your income, your status. You focus on the things that bring you the deeper satisfactions of life, deeper relationships with the people you care about, a relationship with the natural world, your physical health, your personal development as a human being. You know, that these are the things that really, you know, your freedom, the time you have available to engage with your community or with issues larger than yourself. I mean, these are ultimately the things that make for a deeply satisfying life. And that is also, you know, right at the core. It isn't just a question, I guess, in terms of stopping shopping. It's not just a question of giving up things. It's a question of gaining those kinds of things, more of those kinds of things in our lives.
Well, and in the end, time is all we really have. And you have a beautiful turn of phrase here where you describe we're living in a time of time famine, where we're running around and we never seem to have the time. It's a philosophy worth considering, especially in these times. Again, the book is The Day the World Stops Shopping. It's J.B. McKinnon. You can go to James's website, jbmckinnon.com, to find out more about the book. Congratulations on another great book. And my time famine, James, means that I'm only halfway through it. but I definitely will make the time to finish it.
Great. Well, I hope you enjoy it. And thanks again. I'm, you know, always a pleasure to be here.
And I want the rest of you to stick around, because Eva Bartlett will be here right after the break. Thanks again, James. CFUV.ca. Crazy radio for a crazy time. And welcome back to Guerrilla Radio's Home Edition, recorded on this date, June 12th, 2021. Well, the result of last month's Syrian presidential election was hardly surprising. The besieged country's leader, Bashar al-Assad, won by a margin. Poll watchers' cliches like landslide victory can't do justice. Equally unsurprising was the Western press and world community reaction to that victory. Eva Bartlett is an independent Canadian journalist and activist who has lived in and reported extensively from Syria over the last decade of war. She's been one of the few Western witnesses to the destruction of war from where the missiles and bombs land, and one of even fewer to fix properly the blame on those responsible for it. Eva was in Syria again, witnessing both the re-election of Assad and the widespread celebration of national survival. Well, welcome back to the program, Eva.
Thanks. It's been a while. Thanks for having me on.
Well, it's my great pleasure, of course. And yes, it's been too long. Well, now, Eva, you've been busy in the interim, of course. Now, you've traveled to Syria many times over the course of the war there. What was the atmosphere like during your last visit during the elections?
I described it as electric because, you know, first of all, it's worth noting that this was 10 years and some months after the war on Syria began. And this is I was there during the latest presidential elections. And so people outside of Syria could be forgiven for not understanding or knowing that Syrians poured into the streets, not only to vote, but to celebrate the fact that they were holding the elections and to celebrate their president, to be quite honest. And I think that also people could be forgiven for not comprehending how much support he has, because he's widely supported and loved and respected throughout Syria. And this is something I've noticed since my first visit in 2014, and I've continued to notice it over, you know, the years, over 15 visits, some of those for extended periods. Like last year, I was there for half a year due to the borders being closed to COVID. But in 2016, I was there for a couple of months in summer and a couple of months in winter. So all that to say, like I have traveled quite extensively in Syria. I speak colloquial Arabic, and so I've been able to interact one-on-one with Syrians over the years. And for me, too, this was a momentous time because, as you know, Syrians have been facing some of the most heinous terrorism the world has known for the past decade. And the powers that the UK, the US-UK Gulf Turkish-Israeli alliance, almost certainly believed Syria would crumble within the first few months, but Syria did not. So 10 years on, Syria has paid a huge price, but is still standing, is still intact, and is not completely demolished. And to see the fact, again, that they held the elections, but also to see the joy and exuberance of Syrians celebrating their victory, quite frankly, was really moving for me. So it was an electric time to be there.
Well, that Syria still stands is amazing, and I think there's no reason for anyone to have believed that it wouldn't have fallen, given the enemies that it faced and the challenges that they put in front of it. And one of those is, of course, the press, the media out here. The election results, should be noted that Bashar al-Assad's victory, to call it a landslide, really doesn't do it justice. It was a complete wipeout. 90-something percent of the cast votes went for him. And of course, that prompts the press here in Canada and the West generally to say, well, this is obviously a put-up job. This is false. Nobody's that popular. What's your take on this, the fairness of this election?
Yeah, well, I mean, I anticipated the media reaction. I think there was an article I wrote about the fact that I titled it Western Nations Want Democracy in Syria So Badly, They Close Embassies and Prevent Syrians from Voting in Presidential Elections. So the last presidential elections were in 2014. And most Western nations closed Syrian embassies around 2012, officially, like maybe some of them maybe kept nominal figures in place, but without any sort of real power in the embassies. But before the 2014 elections, they made sure that Syrians in Western nations could not vote unless they came to Syria to do so. And just an aside, I happen, and this is very well related to the question of the legitimacy of the Syrian vote. In 2014, I was in Lebanon. I had been in Syria for a few weeks, and I was waiting for my first journalist visa, which I ended up waiting well over a month for, as another aside. But in doing so, I happened to be in Lebanon during the presidential elections. So I thought, okay, well, I'm just going to go to the embassy. I didn't have anyone guiding me. I just got on a local bus, which was crammed full of Syrians, rode as far as we could towards the embassy, which is just outside of Beirut, and walked the rest of the way, which is, I don't know, 3, 4, 5 kilometers. And it was, the mood was like a party. It was like they were chanting, they had their flags, they had their Bashar al-Assad t-shirts. And I stayed there for a good many hours talking with people, asking them, you know, why are you here? And the resounding answer was, we want to vote for our president. We love him, et cetera. Some people were less loving and they were just saying, like, look, he's better than the other options. But the majority that I spoke with actually really liked and respected him. So that's 2014. And on that day, the embassy was due to close at 7 p.m., having opened at 7 a.m. It stayed open until midnight, and then it stayed open the second day to accommodate all the voters. So I make that point to note, like, these were people who by all rights could have not voted. There was no quote-unquote regime authorities putting a gun to their head. They came out willingly, and it was a bloody hot day as well, so it wasn't fun to be walking and standing in the sun. But they did so for hours in order to cast their votes and came back again the second day. And those who couldn't vote at the embassy were trying to get into Syria from Lebanon, as I recall. So there was a huge will then to vote. And within Syria, the voting happened, I think, on June 3rd in 2014. And in the lead up to those elections in Syria, terrorists were then occupying eastern Ghouta, Yarmouk, Hajar al-Aswad. These are Damascus and environs areas. And of course, Aleppo and all around the country, they were occupying major areas of cities. And so in the lead up to those elections in 2014, they rained hell down on government held areas. They rained mortars and missiles on these areas in order to attempt to deter Syrians from voting. And also on election day and also on inauguration day, some a week or however many days later. So in 2014, they faced huge difficulties in voting, but they did so. So this year, another kind of notable aspect of it was that this year, in most areas of the country, they didn't face the terrorist mortars and missiles. So as for the legitimacy, you know, I would just say this. Syrians don't care what I care. It hurts me when I read Western pundits and media mocking the elections. But Syrians themselves don't care. You know, they've realized long ago that they will never get a fair trial in Western media. They've been excluded for the past decade from Western media. Western media has cherry-picked Syrian voices and cast aside the vast majority. So as for the what people are calling questioning the legitimacy of the elections, it doesn't matter what you think. What matters is that Syrians came out into the streets and voted for the person that they wanted to vote for. I did ask Johnny Achi. He's a great Syrian-American, very active. He's been coming to Syria throughout the war since 2011. And because it was unclear for myself as well, I was like, well, you know, one person in alternative media is calling it a police state and is saying the elections were a quote unquote sham. So, Johnny, what can you say? There were three candidates. What can you say about how they were chosen? And if I remember correctly, I don't want to fudge the numbers and I haven't pulled it up on Twitter, but I think he said, I might be wrong, I think he said initially there were like maybe 18 candidates, but they had to secure a certain number of votes before they could proceed on. So that means they had to secure the votes in, I believe it was in parliament, until they whittled it down to these three candidates, including Bashar al-Assad. And, you know, I'm not too familiar with voting systems in Canada and America. I frankly think their voting in elections in the West is pointless. And maybe, you know, the allegations of dead voters voting for Biden might make that point ring home. But from Johnny's perspective, it seems like, you know, the candidates were vetted fairly. And then the rest of it is history, people coming into the streets and voting.
Well, just the reaction that you described, too. And I've seen some of your posts online, the photographs, you know, people partying in the street. Of course, we know that, you know, the Internet, you can't trust everything you see. But I'm really interested amongst the diaspora, especially in Germany, where the Syrians living in Germany were, as you mentioned, they were forbidden to vote in their home election. I mean, how they got away with that one, I don't even know. What about the mood amongst the diaspora or those that you know that you've talked to about going home? Is there a realistic hope, a desire to return to Syria and begin the long process of rebuilding the damage that's been inflicted upon their country over this last decade?
So I'll just touch upon Germany and the diaspora there. I mean, I can't say definitively what percentage of Syrians living there since the war began are pro or anti-government, pro or anti-Assad. I would say there are certainly incentives for people, even if they might be pro-government, to declare that they're anti-government. Incentives being, you know, being able to stay in Germany. And then in contrast, I know that, well, I spoke with a Syrian living in Germany. He was saying there were threats that if Germany was to allow Syrians to actually vote, which they did not, people wanted to go and film and photograph the Syrians that came to vote and then call for their deportation. And then a friend of mine, Kaber Kalmassian of Syriana Analysis, which I highly recommend, a great channel, very informative and educated analysis, he himself has been harassed and attacked for his political views, which are pro-Syrian sovereignty. So in Germany, the climate for Syrians is not fair. It's not fair. It's not safe at all. But as for the question, and I'll also just say in Canada, I have a number of Syrian friends that wanted to vote. Some of them did come to Syria in order to vote, but the rest that were unable to leave Canada at this time for various reasons weren't able to vote. But and there was a couple of years ago or more, they were going to open an honorary consulate to not only to serve like in terms of voting times, but to serve all the other needs that embassies or consulates serve their citizens abroad, you know, registering births or deaths or marriages, etc. But they did not open that consulate. Christia Freeland, our neo-Nazi supporting deputy prime minister now? Pretty sure she had a role in ensuring that did not open. As for the return to Syria, I think that there are a number of factors to consider. For example, now Syria is at peace. So, you know, whereas when I was going to Syria in 2014 and the years following, you risked being, you know, killed or maimed by a mortar fired by the terrorist occupying Eastern Ghouta at any time of day, really. And particularly Syrian children going to and from school risked being injured because that's one of the times that terrorists really heavily rained down mortars on Damascus and the countryside. So now you would expect, okay, well, there, you know, the only area really occupied by terrorists is Idlib, excluding, of course, the Turkish and U.S. Occupiers who are also committing acts of terrorism against the Syrian people. So the rest of the region, the rest of the country is generally safe. But that said, it's not enticing to return right now. And the primary reason is the sanctions, the immoral and criminal sanctions against the Syrian people, which mean it's almost impossible to do any number of things, to import the materials for reconstruction, import materials for manufacturing medicines, or prosthetic limbs, for example. The sanctions are affecting every strata, every factor of life. And what was his name? Jeffrey, was it James Jeffrey? He was one of these U.S. talking head representatives. I believe it was last year. He said something to the effect that we know the sanctions are going to cause, they're going to screw your economy. They're going to cause hyperinflation. And that's, of course, one of the goals, as you know, with sanctions the U.S. implies and their allies apply to countries around the world. But it had precisely that effect. I was in Syria last year, as I said, for 6 months. The Caesar, quote-unquote, Protection Act was enforced in, I think it was in June last year. And I have to say, it's such a sadistic name, Protection Act, when they know damn well that they're targeting the Syrian people. And since that time, the economy has just really gone nuts. The lira in 2011, the Syrian pound was around 50 pounds to a dollar. In the years from that I've been going to Syria, 2014 and on, it was around between 450, 500 or so, 600 pounds to the dollar. Now it's anywhere from like 3,000 to 4,000 pounds to the dollar. So whereas the cost, the lira has hyperinflated, the people, their salaries haven't changed, so they can't afford. I mean, it's just heartbreaking to hear people talk about how they can't afford to feed their children properly. Like, just one, I've asked many people when I was there this time, like, okay, explain to me how you're able to feed your two kids or whatever. And, one person just gave an example. I bought vegetables just for a few days, and it cost £15,000. My salary is £60,000. That's a quarter of my salary gone just on vegetables. And, most people have adapted to a vegetarian diet. If they eat meat, it's a minute amount once a month. And they're just suffering immeasurably. There's a fuel crisis. The U.S. is actively engaged in looting Syrian resources. Last year, there were wildfires all over Syria, although it's quite likely they were set. I mean, there were reports of U.S. helicopters, I believe, setting fires in Syria's eastern countryside. And so you have all these factors of, like, it's very similar to how Israel has intentionally decimated Gaza's economy. In fact, it's very parallel. It's just not as long going. So back to your question, there's stability in Syria, but people, why would they return if the economy is so shattered and if rebuilding can't occur on a large scale?
Well, Eva, and when you make that Gaza comparison, you of course, were also in Gaza too and have witnessed what goes on there. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with Eva Bartlett. Eva is an independent Canadian journalist and activist. She's lived and reported from Syria and Gaza, as I mentioned, over the last decade. She's been one of the few Western witnesses to the destruction of war, and she reports from where the missiles and bombs land instead of when where they're launched. She was in Syria, again, witnessing the re-election of Bashar al-Assad just recently. Well, when you mentioned Chrystia Freeland, I think the proper term, her official term, Eva, is prime minister in waiting. And talking about the sanctions, now that reminds of Madeleine Albright and her reaction to the question by Leslie Stahl way back when about the sanction regime against Iraq, saying that the 500,000 child deaths was estimated was worth the price to bring down the dictator there, Saddam Hussein. And Bashar al-Assad is often referred to as a dictator, his government as an authoritarian one. I'm looking at a Counterpunch article that was put up yesterday by Jeff Klein, and Jeff Klein seems like a very nice fellow. He's with an organization called MAPA, Massachusetts Peace Action, and his article, Eva, is trying to clear up the confusion about Syria. He typifies, and it reminds me of how people talk about Julian Assange, but he opens up, I'll read one of his opening statements. He says, for many of the progressive left outside Syria, the main emphasis has been to center and condemn the authoritarian government of Bashar al-Assad, much as this criticism is well-founded. And then he goes on, but he doesn't say why it's well-founded. Mm-hmm. What about this idea of Bashar al-Assad? He is a mystery to people in the West, primarily because our source of information is so skewed and awful. But who is Bashar al-Assad? Is he the monster, or is he a dictator or a demon? Discuss.
Neither. It's also very much worth emphasizing that in the years prior to the war in Syria, which began in early 2011, Assad was lauded as a reformer, a mild-mannered doctor, which he is, actually. He's an eye doctor. And he was not meant to be president. His older brother died in a car crash, and Bashar was projected into the position when Hafez al-Assad died. But yeah, prior to 2011, he was lauded as opening up the country, making democratic reforms, But Bashar, when things started in 2011, there were criticisms that he wasn't being stern enough because, again, contrary to how the Western media portrayed events in 2011, it was not all unarmed protesters. It was not all peaceful protesters. And in some regions, the security forces were being gunned down and attacked by armed people amongst these protests. And so there were some criticisms that Bashar al-Assad should have been stricter. And I also would ask people to imagine, especially Americans, how would whomever, it doesn't matter if it was Obama, whomever's in power, how would the American authorities react if a certain city, New York, Washington, was suddenly infested by people wielding guns and firing at governmental agencies and also civilians? I don't think, I mean, that's a rhetorical question, but I think everybody knows how that would be dealt with. They would be dealt with very strictly. In Syria, it was complex. Bashar was trying to de-escalate the situation. I've interviewed a soldier who was sent to Dara, which is called the quote-unquote birthplace of the quote-unquote revolution. And he said, we were sent, there were a few hundred of us, and we were only sent with batons. And we were being chased every Friday after prayers. We were being chased by these mobs that had guns, that had Molotov cocktails, and they had other weapons that were assaulting us and injuring and killing soldiers and police among us. And we were specifically told we could not have weapons, and this lasted for a few weeks. So there's a lot of misinformation, including from Counterpunch, unfortunately. I would recommend, if people really want a good sense of how things played out in the early days, Stephen Gowan's The Revolutionary Distemper That Wasn't, and Sharmeen Narwani, who wrote, I think this is on RT, The Hidden Massacre. And this gives a lot of insight into what was happening in those early months, which you would never find until now. You still would never find it in Western media. The other thing to keep in mind is that by now, you know, by 2021, we're well aware, if you're really researching and following Syria, that this was a premeditated war upon Syria. And this is something the U.S. and its allies had been striving for years, if not decades before. So it makes sense that the Western and Gulf and Zionist media would depict Bashar al-Assad as the various terms that I'm not going to replicate. But if you do go to Syria and just spend, God, you don't even need to spend more than a week. But I mean, I'm talking after having spent years and years and years there, you will find that people in Syria, the vast majority, unless they have some sort of Western illusions, like Western, I mean, Western backed. I don't mean like illusions for democracy or political change. Like, number one, we stand with Assad. Number two, he isn't these things that Western media is saying. He's our frankly, and I know it sounds cheesy, but they will say he's our beloved president, Dr. Bashar al-Assad. So it's hard for people in the West to comprehend because there has been so much propaganda across, not just in media, but everywhere in supposed anti-war groups like Code Pink, in Netflix, White Helmets documentary. It's very pervasive. But I'm speaking as somebody who's gone on my own dime or crowdfunded to Syria and mingled with Syrians and spoke directly with them. And people can say what they want about my perspective, but I know that I can sleep at night knowing that I'm speaking the truth.
Well, and you've been roundly attacked for your writings and your writings on North Korea too, when you've been there as well and taken a contrary position, contrary to the ocean of propaganda that we're getting on this side of the Atlantic. Eva, we're fast running out of time, but the situation you mentioned, Israel and the ongoing war between Syria and Israel, or against Syria, I would posit anyway, but just a couple of days ago, 11 Syrians killed by Israeli missiles, and the article from Fox News cites Israel having launched rocket attacks against Syria over the course of the war there these last 10 years, more than 120 times. I imagine it's probably more than that. Even
yes.
So, the situation right now, though, Eva, then in our final minutes, you mentioned before that the sanctions, there's also the occupation by America and its allies of certain areas, the oil producing area, notably, and the farming area. You mentioned the drought and the fires. The wildfires. I read recently that their wheat fields were being set alight as well to deprive even further Syrians of being able to feed themselves. What's your final assessment then of Syria's present state and how people can find out, as you mentioned some sources, but how they can find out more and get involved in making their voices heard and perhaps helping the people of Syria?
You know, I think the most important thing the most important thing for Syria is for these sanctions to be lifted. Because again, it's not just about importing materials, but it's the sanctions are scaring off companies that would do business with Syria and revive, in to some extent, Syria's economy. So the sanctions are manifold in their deadliness. So I mean, if people want to really, you know, try to support Syria, it's very difficult to send hard cash to Syria. I mean, you'd have to send it on somebody, and not that many people are going to Syria. So in terms of like sending donations, it's very difficult. Rather than donations, that is, it's donations are of course needed and welcomed, but that's kind of like a band-aid, right? Just like UN aid to Palestinians, when that's not addressing the real issue. The real issue is lifting these sanctions so that Syria can work with its allies in rebuilding the country and rebuilding its economy. So I would encourage people to find, you know, other local groups wherever you're living that are working to put pressure in whatever way on the U.S. Not that I have to say I'm quite cynical, because in the end, the U.S. doesn't really care. It's a rogue state. It doesn't really care what anybody thinks. But anyway, your energy could be directed towards both the issue of getting the sanctions lifted, and also before then informing people on just how deadly these sanctions are.
Well, and to be fair to Jeff Klein over at Massachusetts Peace Action, he does say, and speaking for that organization, quote, "We demand an end to U.S. military involvement in Syria, recognition of Syria's territorial sovereignty, respect for international law, and assistance in the country's reconstruction." So there still is this back and forth in the so-called progressive left. It drives me nuts, though, when I hear somebody that has all the prefaces their statements by saying, well, yes, but we know that Bashar al-Assad is a monster, and we know that Julian Assange is a creepy guy that paints his cell with human feces. These kinds of backhanded support drives me around the twist.
Oh no, I fully agree, and thank you for saying that, because I was just about to say something similar. If you want to actually truly support Syria, stop it with these caveats. Just say you're anti-intervention, you're anti-war in Syria, you're anti-sanctions. You don't need to say, but Bashar is blah blah blah. The terrorists that the West have funded have actually gassed the Syrian people. And as for war crimes, what court of law has held a trial and determined that Bashar al-Assad is guilty of war crimes? Has any court? No. It's only the court of the Western corporate media. That's all it is, and Human Rights Watch. So, again, drop the caveats. Just say, I oppose the war in Syria. I oppose the sanctions. Khalas. And whatever people want to think of their leader, that's up to Syrians. It's not up to us.
And again, that Jeff Klein article is trying to clear up confusion about Syria. Read it yourself at Counterpunch, noticing those caveats. But that sort of chicken little or chicken shit kind of position at the beginning of it, really, there's no need for that. Your work is an inspiration to all of us, Eva, and I do wish you good luck in your further endeavors and in your life in Russia. Are you ever going to come back to Canada?
Well, I will come back for a visit. I'm not sure when, when travel will allow that, but I plan on staying here in the long term.
All right. Well, I hope you're very happy, you and your dogs both, and I thank you for coming on the show again, eh?
Thank you so much. Thank you.
And I want to thank JB McKinnon and all the good folks that make the wheels turn week in and week out. There's great programming coming up. You know that, but that's all I've got. Until the next time.